We're examining America's complex and often opaque parole system through the story of one man, Jacob Wideman, who was convicted of killing his camp roommate, Eric Kane. He's at the center of a new series called Violation from WBUR and the Marshall Project. This week, we're hearing that Jake is back in prison for a technical violation of his parole. He's still trying to get out and is finally ready to talk about a trauma in his past. And we want you to know that this episode describes violent acts and sexual assault. Please take care while listening. Reporter Beth Schwartzapfel picks up the story.
Despite cold feet at first, Jake said he thought he had mentioned this childhood trauma indirectly enough times that people would probably figure it out.
There didn't seem to be any compelling reason to not just open up completely and talk about it. And maybe talking about it will benefit others, will encourage others who are in a situation similar to mine to open up themselves.
This is what he told me. Over the course of 2 years when he was in elementary school,
I was sexually abused by two different men. During the same time period, in two different places, one in Laramie, who was an employee of the school I was attending at the time, and one actually at Tuckahoe.
Laramie was where Jake grew up, and Tuckahoe was the camp owned by his grandfather, where he had been spending summers for as long as he could remember. Tuckahoe sponsored the cross-country trip that Jake and Eric took together many years later. But during this period, Jake was too young to even go to sleepaway camp and lived with his parents during the summers in a house on the camp property.
All I know is that it was nightmarish for me because there was no safe place. Those were my two homes, the two places I associated most closely with home. You know, was Tuckahoe and Laramie where we lived. And for that period of time, in neither place was I safe.
This abuse during Jake's formative years, he said, laid the foundation for his mental illness and its devastating consequences, for his shame and self-loathing and terror of being perceived as weird or broken, for the obsessive, violent thoughts and images, all of which escalated throughout his childhood and teenage years and led to that terrible night in 1986.
My instinctive mode was, for decades afterwards, to be obsessive about protecting myself and not putting myself in vulnerable situations, whether it be physical vulnerability, emotional or psychological vulnerability, even spiritual vulnerability.
Jake says he thinks he was born with the temporal lobe syndrome, that it was unrelated to the abuse, but it exacerbated all the feelings and patterns and behaviors that the abuse engendered. That summer, when he was 16, Jake says, the intrusive, obsessive thoughts of harming himself or someone else were almost nonstop. On top of managing the thoughts themselves was the near constant task of pretending he wasn't having them. While at camp and on the Western trip, living 24/7 with other people and acting like everything was fine. The hypervigilance was exhausting and left him jumpy and on edge. The night of August 12th, he thought going out to the car to listen to some music would help calm him. And it did for a time, he said. He even laid down on his bed and fell asleep with his clothes on for a while. But he woke up around 1 a.m. in the midst of what he now knows was a temporal lobe seizure.
It was a waking up and immediately being in that hyper state of just sweating, thoughts racing, of shaking, of feeling physically out of control.
He said it was the most intense episode he had ever experienced in his life. Earlier that night, when he had rummaged through his bag to look for his tapes, he had pulled out a souvenir hunting knife he had bought at Yellowstone earlier that week, he said. It was sitting on top of his suitcase.
And I just remember seeing that and seeing Eric.
Eric was lying on his bed, sound asleep. Watching Eric navigate being different and being teased brought up all of Jake's insecurities about feeling different, about his shame and his fear of being found out, about his terror of being vulnerable, about his inability to protect himself when it mattered most. Again, these are insights Jake says he developed over the course of decades. At that moment, in 1986, all he knew was that he woke up shaking and sweating and hot and completely out of control, he says. And he felt this compulsion to destroy all of those overwhelming feelings and memories that arose when he saw Eric lying there, sleeping.
I saw in Eric at the time a mirror for all the things that I hated in myself and all the things that I hated that had happened to me. And even that is nuanced because I didn't feel hatred for Eric. I didn't feel anger at him, explicit anger at him. But there was something inside of me which held that mirror up, and which ultimately, when I did wake up in the midst of a seizure, and when I did wake up in the midst of a storm of all those emotions that grew out of the abuse I experienced and everything that had happened since then, in just a moment's time, I looked at Eric and I saw all of that, and all of it came to the front.
Did you think about going for a walk? Did you think about using the knife on yourself? Were there other things that occurred to you, or did it all happen too fast to consider alternatives?
No, it just happened immediately. There was no time for thought.
1 minute remaining.
There was no time. There was no consideration of anything. I woke up and saw those things and did what I did.
That's Jake Weidman ending this excerpt of the new podcast series Violation from WBUR and the Marshall Project. And Beth Schwartz-Upfall, who reported this series, is here in the studio with me. Beth, first, congratulations on this series and welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, that's intense. I mean, this last piece, there's so much in there. But bring us up to date. Where is Jake now? What's the latest?
So Jake is still in prison, and he'll be in prison indefinitely. There's no official date when he'll get out. He's fighting with the state right now in court, and he hopes that a judge will release him, but there's no guarantee of that.
Yeah, just to remind listeners, he did win parole, but was returned on a very technical violation. When we're talking about this case, though, Beth, we have to remember the victim here is Eric Kane, and Jake admits to killing him back when both were boys. What have you heard from Eric Kane's family about this series? How are they reacting?
I have heard nothing from the Kanes. I reached out to them many times over the course of my reporting, hoping that they would contribute to the series in some way. Wanted very much to have their perspective, to have their love for Eric come through as much as I could. But I didn't expect to hear from them, and I have not. I think that they're just trying to kind of have their privacy.
Mm. This series took a hard look at both Jake's individual case, but also at the parole system. You know, it's hard to understand for someone seeking parole. It's hard to navigate. What stood out to you as you were reporting on how parole is administered here in the U.S.?
I've been reporting on parole for years. So when I started on the series, I thought I knew all the important things there were to know. The thing that I think struck me in working on this was that parole board members essentially have an impossible task. Their job is to predict what human beings are going to do in the future. Mm. And there's no one in this world who can do that. I mean, none of us can even say what we ourselves are going to do in the future. And then not only are they tasked with doing that, but if things don't go as they thought they would, if something goes badly, then they are blamed as if somehow they should have known when I think it's really on us to be thoughtful about what we can reasonably expect from a parole board in a situation like that. I think that's the biggest thing that I learned in working on this, is that they're just really in an impossible position. You just can't win.
Yeah. Do you think Jake Weidman will ever get out of prison?
It is a really hard call. There's a new governor in Arizona. There's a new attorney general. I think that the tone will change. The tone already has changed. There's a lot since Doug Ducey was replaced by Katie Hobbs in Arizona. I think that there's been a lot more emphasis on, rehabilitation, running a humane correction system. And I think that that will influence how things go. But I don't think we can say with any surety what's going to happen.
Beth Schwartzapfel reported the podcast series Violation from WBUR and the Marshall Project. Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for listening.